The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Good afternoon, John Harper for Drew Mariani. Drew will be back tomorrow if you're just joining us. I'm hopeful that you felt the warmth of God's love today, and I think Drew will be putting some warmth on his back tonight in the form of a heating pad or Bengay. He is helping his son move furniture today. For those of you who have done that, and you know Drew's back, which can very easily go into spasms, so we're praying for a safe move and a very comfortable back for Drew as he's back with you tomorrow here on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. Coming up in this hour, a familiar voice, Dr. Paul Kengor, is going to look at a couple of things. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, the Republican from Georgia, is saying, and you've probably heard this because this made news last week, it's probably time for a divorce. And what she meant was America splitting into two countries, basically one with red states and one with blue states. We'll get Dr. Kengor's reaction to that and also start handicapping, because we're only a year away from presidential primaries, and you've already seen some folks move forward in what perhaps will be a campaign on both sides, Republican and Democrat. And we'll handicap that for you coming up in this hour of the Drew Mariani Show. But right now, let's talk about, and this delves a little bit into a history lesson, the Equal Rights Amendment. The Equal Rights Amendment would codify gender equality in the United States Constitution. Now, that was first introduced by Congress 100 years ago, 1923. And you might remember that it finally passed in 1972, but it never ratified. The ERA is getting its first hearing in 40 years today. The Senate Judiciary Committee is meeting to discuss a joint resolution to finally affirm the ERA. 100 years ago, need 38 states to ratify. Virginia was number 38, but that only happened in 2020. So what is the historic next step in the push to codify gender equality in the United States Constitution? And there's even an abortion connection to this. We'll explore that right now. Professor Teresa Stanton Collett teaches at the University of St. Thomas School of Law in Minneapolis. She served on the Pontifical Council for the Family and has testified before Congress. And she has published a number of legal articles and is the co-author of a law casebook on professional responsibility. Professor, welcome back to Relevant Radio.
I'm always delighted to appear on the show.
It's always great to have your voice here and to share your wisdom. A lot has gone on in Washington, D.C. What has happened? I know you've got some news that has come out of Washington, D.C. today. Can you bring us up to date on that?
Sure. I'm delighted to report that those states trying to claim that they had met the 38-state requirement to pass an amendment were rebuffed by the District of Columbia Court of Appeals. And as your listeners may know, the D.C. Circuit is a very influential court. And in this litigation, you had the three states that had, ratified, close quote, the amendment clearly after both the original seven-year time period plus the three-year extension that Congress had passed, which is of questionable validity, but nonetheless, they had gone far beyond that. And the district court, they had come into court and said, you must force the archivist to certify that this is an amendment to the Constitution and publish it as such. And the archivist said, no. You had a seven-year time span in which to get this done. You failed to get it done. Even if we were to take the 3 years addition that was given by Congress, you still failed to get it done. And I'm not going to certify it. And, you know, God bless the archivists for standing strong. And so the lawsuit at the trial court, they lost. And today, in a unanimous three-judge opinion from the D.C. Circuit, those who are trying to claim that the ERA is a legitimate part of our Constitution lost again.
What does the unanimity of those judges tell you?
I think it tells me that regardless of political orientation, facts are facts. And in this instance, in order to prevail, they had to show that there was a clear and indisputable right to require the federal official to act in such a way that was consistent with a clear duty to act. And these three judges unanimously ruled that there is not a clear and indisputable right to require the archivist to do this, because the archivist has, if you will, in Europe they call it a margin of appreciation, in the United States we call it discretion, has discretion to actually decide whether it has been properly certified where the certification requirements are set forth in the proposed amendments. And so it's the legal argument borders on frivolous. Now, that's a very serious charge for a lawyer to make. But if these hearings that are coming up, if they really think that the ERA has public support by 38 states, they just need to pass a new one. It's very simple to solve. Mm-hmm.
And also what we're talking about here, Professor, is if the ERA wins passage, the result is this dramatically empowered federal government on issues that decide the impact on women.
No question. And I do want to note for the listeners that the language of this 1972 proposed ERA was equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of sex. It wasn't gender. And there's some real confusion about that, especially given the transgender movement in this country. Gender has historically been understood as the manifestation of your biological identity. And so that manifestation includes the fact that girls and women have certain physiological limitations that men don't have. That's why the competition in sports is such a hotly debated topic. But gender, I choose to wear a skirt. If a man chooses to wear a skirt, it's a social convention that unless he's Scottish, it is considered very odd. And so it doesn't say gender, it says sex. So the first fight will be, and we shouldn't even be entertaining this fight because it's so clear that the ERA, as passed in 72, is dead. But nonetheless, if by some odd set of circumstances it gets certified, the first fight will be, what does sex mean? Does it mean the biological reality, or does it mean the way people self-identify, or does it mean the sexual identity, the gender identity? What does it mean? And there are actually 9 different definitions floating out there among the courts.
There are 9. Did you say within the courts, Professor Collette?
I did. There's a very interesting Kansas Court of Appeal opinion that actually goes through the 9 and says, how do we decide what sex is? Is it by genitalia? Is it by genetics? Is it by how the person manifests in society? And there's this litany of tests. And I confess, when that opinion came down, I believe I was still teaching in Texas at that time. And I thought, good Lord, now in every piece of legislation that we're going to talk about sex, distinctions among sex, we're going to have to define it to avoid this, buffet of definitions that the courts appear to have created.
I'm curious, as a lawyer, how do we get to a buffet of having the courts with 9 definitions of what sex is? How do we get to this point?
Because there's a very aggressive movement that is motivated largely by gender ideology, as the Holy Father has described it, that refuses to respect both the historical and biological reality of the fact that with a very tiny, tiny, less than 1% exception, we are created as a man or a woman. And it manifests itself both physiologically, and it manifests itself in our inclinations, and it manifests itself in our social conventions. And Pope Francis, while many listeners on Relevant Radio, I myself on occasion have to swallow hard when the Holy Father has spoken, but nonetheless, he's been very clear on this, that this gender ideology is a death knell for civilization.
Mm-hmm. And if we've got nine different definitions of sex, as we talk about the ERA, and of course, the breaking news of the afternoon, a three-judge panel in Washington, D.C. has really kind of put the Equal Rights Amendment back on square one. So, you know, here we are 100 years later after it was first introduced by Congress, basically back where it was 100 years ago, or even in 1972, when the ERA really got its very first hearing. So if we've got nine different definitions of sex, then the slippery slope is that the ERA is going to go right headfirst into the abortion issue.
That is true. And in 1972, when they were passing this, and remember, it takes two-thirds of both houses to pass a constitutional amendment. And when they were trying to pass this, they were very coy about whether it would include a right to abortion. And our proponents were very coy. And there were some wonderful legislators who really tried to hold their feet to the fire and say, look, you know, if it doesn't apply to abortion, here's an amendment that says expressly it doesn't apply to abortion. And they refused to allow that. And so it really is clear. Now, people aren't as coy now. The abortion industry is absolutely giddy with the possibility that there would be an ERA, an Equal Rights Amendment related to sex, because they are absolutely convinced with significant basis that it will, in fact, make abortion a fundamental right in all 50 states of the union. And we just fought 50-year battle to get rid of the judicial fiction that the Constitution as it is presently exists does not include a right to abortion. And now we're fighting those battles in all 50 states. And the ERA could, depending on the interpretation by federal courts, eliminate even that battle. And I will say, you know, I was at a rally today, United for Life in Minnesota, because we've got some dreadful proposed legislation. And all the pro-life organizations came together, and I spoke at it. And I mentioned that, you know, it's so discouraging when you see these various proposed state constitutional amendments, like in Montana and in Kansas, go down in defeat. But my priest tried to encourage me. He said, Teresa, do you not understand that you've just punched the devil in the nose with this Dobbs v. Jackson case? And he's going to punch back. And that's what's happening. So we have to stand firm, and we have to continue to believe that we are a country that will ultimately recognize the inherent beauty and dignity of every person from the beginning of fertilization to natural death. And I believe that. I take great comfort in that when I'm still working on a brief at 3 a.m.
Professor Teresa Stanton-Collette teaches at the University of St. Thomas School of Law in Minneapolis, our guest today here on the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app, talking about the Equal Rights Amendment that would codify gender equality in the United States Constitution. Had some setbacks today in a very influential D.C. court. And, of course, we are inviting you to call and be a part of the conversation at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. I'm curious, you mentioned that you were at a rally today, United for Life Minnesota, and you spoke at that. How many people were at the rally? What's the mood of that rally, and what does your organization do next up against some of these laws that are proposed in Minnesota?
We are excited. We are energized. We think we're going to prevail. So in Minnesota, the Democrats hold a majority in both houses, and they have been forcing the leaders of the party have been forcing their members to march lockstep to create a statutory fundamental right to abortion, to eliminate all protections related to abortions. Things as simple and as sensible as, gee, if there's a complication, you need to tell the Department of Health so we can figure out if there's some sort of pattern of complications here, or you need to let us know why women are seeking abortion so if we can help them, then we need to pass legislation to do that. They're eliminating parental involvement in abortion. So a girl at age 12, an early age to become pregnant, but certainly not beyond reality, doesn't even have to consult her parents. In fact, she can be completely coerced by an adult sexual predator or human trafficker. So we really are we're in the midst of a huge fight. But these organizations came together, Catholic Conference, Pro-Life Action Ministries, Minnesota Concerned Citizens for Life, Pro-Life Center at the University of St. Thomas that I chair. It was a wonderful rally, and we had five times more Minnesotans show up for our rally than those who support this dreadful legislation had show up last week.
Thanks be to God for that.
Total victory. And our bishops showed up. We had four of our bishops show up. It was wonderful. It's amazing. Yeah.
That's awesome. And I pray that the Minneapolis television stations are out there covering it. So, the success that you had today gets communicated to tens of thousands of Minnesotans. I speak for myself, but I like what your priest said. I would not mind punching the devil in the nose. And perhaps I need to do that more often. And you'll defend me just in case he hauls me in the court. Okay, good. Okay, great. We've got witnesses here, Professor Collette. But also at the same time, when you talk about in both houses of the Minnesota legislature, which is decidedly Democratic, some of these radical abortion laws that they're proposing, including no parental notification. How do you then have a conversation with someone who is proposing that with clarity and charity to explain your side to get that heart or mind changed that is so radical you almost can't even fathom it?
Actually, I have had some success when I was on a faculty down in Texas with a Democratic chair who had himself two young daughters. And the argument I made to him is that, look, if your daughters get secret abortions, A, you won't know who impregnated them. And in Minnesota, we are, according to the FBI, among cities that have child prostitution, we're number 13. Hardly something we should be proud about, right? You won't know who impregnated them. And when that girl comes home, if she starts hemorrhaging, if she has an infection and starts running a temperature and says, oh, mom, it's just COVID, it's just the flu, whatever, then you're not going to know to get that kid to the emergency room. And the chairman at the time said, I can't go home if I vote for this. And I said, can you go get a cup of coffee at least? And he said, that I can do.
Wow.
And there's only a one vote majority in the Senate in Minnesota. We just need a couple of senators to go get a cup of coffee.
Yeah. And it proves again, we always hear that elections have consequences, and that I'm afraid has become such a punchline today that we don't realize the severity of that when we're talking about the issue of a human being's life. But that's really what's at stake when you look at where votes landed in Minnesota to get both houses of the legislature Democratic and us having this conversation now about such radical abortion legislation.
And the reality is that the majority, 70% of Minnesotans, believe that certain restrictions should be supported, including parental notification. So if we can survive this legislative session, I'm also serving as counsel for an organization called Mothers Offering Maternal Support. It's limited to Minnesota moms who have minor daughters, any daughter under the age of 18. Your daughter can be 2 months old, your daughter can be 17. But these women, heroic mothers, came together and they said, Professor Collette, we've got this terrible, which we do, district court opinion where the attorney general simply refused to defend parental notification. Will you represent our organization in trying to do this? And I said, I'd be proud to do that. And so we had our first hearing on January 9th to see if the trial court judge will let us into the case, basically to retry it, because the attorney general of Minnesota, the trial court opinion says multiple times the defendants, meaning the attorney general and the governor of Minnesota, presented no evidence. The defendants presented no evidence. Plaintiffs unrebutted evidence. And the plaintiff's evidence is insane. It's like, oh, well, minors have the same decisional capacity as adult women. Our whole juvenile justice system is based on the fact that juveniles are impulsive and are more likely to make bad decisions than adults. It's a disgrace what the attorney general did in the case.
And I'm just curious about the attorney general's moral compass. I suppose this is a question to ask the Minnesota attorney general, but you know, when you see moral compasses just kind of spinning around, if you ever looked at a compass and you just twirl it around, that just, you know, it spins. And that's what's happening. But as Roman Catholic men and women, how do we get that spiritual compass back to the middle, again, with clarity and charity, to start changing hearts and changing minds? Because we can do a million segments like this, Professor Collette, here on Relevant Radio. But unless we take some definitive action, which we're going to have to account for when we stand in front of God, nothing's going to happen.
We have awesome leadership by the Minnesota Catholic Conference and the bishops, so I don't want it to sound institutional. Archbishop Hebda opened us in prayer today. He did a huge editorial in our diocesan newspaper. He's been a rock star. Bishop Lavore, emeritus, but Bishop Lavore closed us in prayer. I mean, and as I said to the four bishops present, I said, you know, the men in black always show up. And they did. They absolutely showed up. And some of them led the delegations to go talk to the state, a particular state senator or a state representative based on where their parishes were. And so, you know, we just need to be on fire on this because, you know, this is the issue of our times, just like when the Louisiana legislature during the 1960s said, we will excommunicate any state legislator who votes to reestablish segregation in the state, and God bless them.
One more quick question, and we're going to talk about this in the next half hour with Dr. Paul Kangor, just taking a look at 2024 and the presidential lineup. How big of an issue is abortion going to be?
Well, it depends on how smart the Republican Party is, to be honest. In our state election, it was really, really troubling because the Democrats ran all these ads saying that, you know, oh, if you elect the Republican candidates, including Matt Burke, who's awesome, strong pro-lifer, the gubernatorial candidate was not nearly as good. But nonetheless, if you elect these guys, it's going to be, you know, Armageddon. Women are going to, it's the Handmaid's Tale, which was utter nonsense. So they get the majority of both houses. They get the governorship. The attorney general returns to office, notwithstanding his clear dereliction of duty. And now we're seeing the radicalness of the other side.
Yeah.
It's astonishing. And the former Republican president, whose name shall not be spoken because people have such visceral reactions.
Sure.
But the one thing we can say is he put people in place who really cared about mothers and their unborn children and the family. And that's what we need to return to. And there are multiple potential candidates in the Republican field that will do that. Whether or not, you know, the Democrats can field anybody. Those Democrats who are members of Democrats for Life can't even, you know, reach Congress because the party has established such a hard line that abortion is necessary for women's prosperity, happiness, and it's a real insult. You know, I'm a tenured law professor heading an institute. I'm a lawyer that practices before the United States Supreme Court. I have three children and nine grandchildren, and I'm sorry, being pregnant has not impeded my progress.
I'm putting you on speed dial with that CV. Professor Teresa Stanton Collette teaches at the University of St. Thomas School of Law in Minneapolis, and it just goes to show what you and I need to do, not only in prayer, but also in action, to stand up for life and to bring the issues of life to our own communities and our own states. Professor, thanks and God bless.
Thank you so much.
So we talked about abortion being an issue in the 2024 campaign. Who do you think's going to be on both sides? We handicap that with Dr. Paul Kangor next on the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Wish you could hit rewind on that convo? Listen to the podcast on relevantradio.com or anywhere podcasts can be found.
Today's programming is brought to you by St. Gregory Recovery Center in Iowa. More information about their faith-centered addiction treatment is available at relevantradio.com/stgregory.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
John Harper in for Drew this afternoon. He'll be back on tomorrow here on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. In our 24/7 news cycle, I'm sure there are many times when you do a double take and you just say, did I hear that correctly? Did I think they said what they said? And maybe you did a double take last week. I sure did when I heard the term national divorce. National divorce that came from Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, who said, you know what, this country needs a national divorce. We should split into a couple of countries here with red states and blue states, two separate countries. Red states, no constitution. Red states, if you're a Democrat living in a red state and we separate from the rest of the United States, it would be 5 years before you would be eligible to vote. I know it sounds kind of crazy, but these are some of the almost game show-like tactics that you hear from both sides of the aisle. Both sides of the aisle. It's not just red, it's also blue. There are things that just have you scratching your heads. Let's make sense of all of this, especially as we go into a presidential election year. Dr. Paul Kangor is a regular contributor here to the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. Dr. Kangor is a professor of political science at Grove City College in Pennsylvania. Also the executive director of the Center for Vision and Values. He spent a number of years in Washington working with the Reagan administration, and his latest book is called The Devil and Bella Dodd. Dr. Kangor, always good to have you on.
John, it's always good to be with you. Drew's my buddy, but when he's not in, I'm always happy to talk to you. You're my buddy, too.
Well, thank you very much. I do appreciate that. The United States of America, or is it? You have heard, perhaps, Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene. And, you know, she's way over there to the right, as there are members of the Democratic Party that are way over to the left. And she is gaining a little support among fellow Republican lawmakers in Congress to break up the United States into two countries. She calls it the national divorce, her term. What do you make of that?
Well, I would say that as Catholics, we should resist divorce, right? We should not want divorce. I'd say as Americans, we likewise should not want a national divorce. No, that's not what America is, what it's all about. I mean, I am an American. I want America to remain together. One of my favorite quotes, John, is from Ronald Reagan, who said, America is less of a place than an idea. And you know, it's the idea of America that's brought everybody here from all over the world, your ancestors, my ancestors, for decades, hundreds of years. Even as I talked about this with Drew last week, Angela Davis, the infamous, notorious female Marxist, Communist Party USA member, black nationalist. She learned recently, we saw on Henry Louis Gates Jr.'s show, Finding Your Roots, that she had ancestors aboard the Mayflower of all things. So, I mean, we're truly a melting pot, and we've all come together in this amazing country. And no, you don't want to break it apart. And yes, yeah, less of a place than it is an idea, but it's a place too. People came here for the idea to settle in the place. So, and sadly, it's not just people like Marjorie Taylor Greene on the right, but people on the left are pushing it too. On the far left, who don't like whatever the Supreme Court is doing on abortion or whatever else. But I guess you and I could walk through and kind of tease out the reasons why they're saying this, which maybe even some people listening would be sympathetic to. And in fact, there's probably reasons there that I'm sympathetic to, but overall, as a principle, as a concept, I say we Catholics, we Americans, we should reject this idea of divorce.
What do you think about politics becoming more of a reality show, and what should we do as faithful citizens to try to get our politicians from our local communities on up back on track?
It's a good question, and I don't always know. And oftentimes what happens is it's the politician to make the most noise, who get the most publicity, and that's who we end up talking about. People like Congresswoman Greene here. people from the other side, the other extreme, maybe people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you know, the Squad, Ilhan Omar, folks like that. But I think probably most people in the country that run for office at local levels for their school boards, for their borough councils, for state legislatures, they're not demagogues. They're not out there trying to stir the pot. They're trying to make their community a better place. And I guess part of the way you could do that is support candidates like that and maybe become a candidate like that yourself. But too often the people with the big mouths get the spotlight and they end up becoming lightning rods. I think they like being lightning rods. They like the attention. Maybe we shouldn't give it to them. But on the other hand, an idea like this, yeah, that's too hard not to talk about. And again, beyond people like the Congresswoman, this has been pushed by pundits for a while now. So this idea of a national divorce separating the country, this really precedes our politicians in Washington.
As you mentioned, Dr. Kangor, there are those on the left that are radical. There are those on the right that are radical. The ones on the right have gotten a little more publicity, especially through the nomination process for Kevin McCarthy as Speaker of the House. As a Reagan Republican and hearing some of these ideas and seeing what drives the Republican Party today, is there a red line for you where you say, I can't be associated with this anymore?
Well, I mean, Ronald Reagan certainly would have really rejected the idea of breaking up the country. I mean, he was, and interesting too here, John, and maybe this gets to my point about teasing out some of the, I guess, stronger points that some of these advocates have. Ronald Reagan talked about states' rights too, and for the left, they've now turned that into what they call a code word for racism or a dog whistle for racism. But when Ronald Reagan talked about states' rights, he meant the idea of federalism. Federalism is a major part of constitutionalism, of conservatism. And for people listening who don't know what I'm talking about here, you look up the 10th Amendment to the Constitution. Just look it up. You Google 10th Amendment to the Constitution. It's like one sentence. It's maybe not even two dozen words. And it says that, you know, that the power is not granted to the federal government are reserved exclusively to the states. And what's happened since the era of FDR, since the era of LBJ, the New Deal, the Great Society, and really this is what pushed Ronald Reagan out of the Democratic Party, is that more and more these powers that were the province of states and localities have been usurped by Washington. It wasn't supposed to be that way. So there really is now this imbalance. This true federalism is lacking between powers in Washington and powers in the states. And Democratic governors will tell you this as well, too. In fact, Jimmy Carter, who's been in hospice care, Jimmy Carter is a Democratic governor in the South in Georgia, had the same concerns. Look at a liberal like Governor Cuomo in New York during the COVID crisis, asserting the powers of the state of New York because Donald Trump was president in Washington, or Gavin Newsom, a liberal governor in California. Same thing. And all of a sudden they become these advocates for states' rights when they want to. And all of a sudden now you even have some liberals who want states' rights because they don't like what the U.S. Supreme Court has done in reversing Dobbs and Roe v. Wade.
Yep.
So I think one thing that we need to get back to is that proper understanding of the 10th Amendment and respecting the separation of powers between state governments and the federal government in Washington. That's how the founders literally intended it to be.
And picking up on that point, Dr. Paul Kangor, in our conversation about states' rights, we see this going on at the Supreme Court this afternoon. Even though the conservative majority led by Chief Justice John Roberts is saying we're a little skeptical about the legality of wiping out student debt, you've got six states saying, wait a minute, you can't do this unilaterally, President Biden.
And there will be states, too, on the liberal Democrat side, including states like California, that will want to do that.
Right.
And the liberals in California will be claiming states' rights all of a sudden, right? And you want to people on the left say, well, that's a racist dog whistle. States' rights code word for the Klan. They don't do that when their side is claiming states' rights. So, yeah, which is not to say that there haven't been racists and segregationists in the past who did use states' rights in order to advance Jim Crow laws and so forth. No question about that. But that certainly wasn't someone like a Ronald Reagan. It wasn't somebody like a Jimmy Carter. Not somebody like, you know, Andrew Cuomo.
Yeah.
Or Gavin Newsom. But you know, again, this proper balance between the two is something I think the country needs to get back to in order to, back to the original point of a national divorce, to have a better functioning America, where the system works like it was originally intended to be. And when your side doesn't get its way at the Supreme Court or whatever, you know, you don't grab your toys and go home. Start stomping your feet. That's it. Divorce. I mean, you know, that's not the way this works. You win some, you lose some. That, you know, that's politics. That's the way it goes.
Do we just look at a time when Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill got together as something of sainted memory? Can we ever bring the country back to that degree of sanity, cooperation?
Well, it's a good question, John. And Ronald Reagan's historic tax cut, August 13th, 1981, the one he signed at the Reagan Ranch in California. You know, the Washington Post called it one of the most remarkable examples of bipartisan cooperation in American history. So it was an overwhelmingly Democratic House run by Tip O'Neill, and the Democrats in that House supported that tax cut. In fact, most of the Democrats in the Senate, which was a Republican Senate at that time, supported that tax cut, including a young Democratic senator from Delaware named Joe Biden. You know, Biden supported the Reagan tax cut. So will we get back to that place? I don't know. But, you know, nowadays, more than I think ever we've ever seen before in history, there are party line votes on every issue. And every Supreme Court justice that comes up, it's a party line vote on the Supreme Court justice. It's not that long ago that even somebody like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I think her vote, John, was something like 96-4 or 97-3 in the Senate, where even the Republicans said, you know, she's a liberal. I disagree with her. I don't agree with her views on the Constitution. But, you know, the president is allowed to pick whoever, you know, the president prefers to pick for the Supreme Court, as long as a person has a conventional, you know, judicial record and a judicial background and has qualifications. The president should get who he wants on the court. And then that all changed with liberals, with people like Judge Bork. And I think, did any Democrats at all vote for Neil Gorsuch? I don't think so. Brett Kavanaugh? No. Amy Coney Barrett? No. None of the Trump appointees. They didn't get a single Democratic vote. So we've entered this really kind of awful period of intense partisan divisions. And I don't know. I don't know if there is any way of going back.
Dr. Paul Kanger with us this afternoon here on the Drew Mariani Show. And as we continue our conversation in a couple of moments, let's start handicapping 2024 as we continue here on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. Your life connected.
John Harper in for Drew this afternoon. He's back tomorrow here on Relevant Radio. Do you realize a year from today we will be in the thick of presidential primary season? So who do you think the candidates will be? We're kind of handicapping here with Dr. Paul Kanger, who is a professor of political science at Grove City College and the executive director of the Center for Vision and Values. Dr. Kanger, right now, as we have this conversation on February 28th, Donald Trump continues to lead the polls with Republicans, although the track record of success in terms of getting Republicans elected was narrow in 2020. And then, of course, you've got the age issue with Joe Biden and no bench on the Democratic side. Have both parties kind of painted themselves into a corner?
Yeah, I think they kind of have. And at the very least, I think Donald Trump is painting the Republicans in a corner, because if he runs again, yeah, I don't know who else is going to run. Now, Governor DeSantis in Florida, he's clearly running, John. I mean, he's been around the country giving speeches and and making appearances. He's definitely, according to the polls, usually second behind Donald Trump in the polls. I think the most recent poll I saw was Trump up over DeSantis, maybe 41% to 28% or something like that. So yeah, that might surprise some people on the Republican side, but DeSantis is still somebody that most Americans don't know. And
right.
Yeah, most Americans don't pay attention to politics and don't know who any of these people are until they really get deep into the campaign. So yeah, so Donald Trump is kind of benefiting there from name recognition. Now, with Biden and the Democrats, I guess it's kind of the same thing. So long as Biden decides that he's running again, he's kind of painted the Democrats into a corner. You know, he's going to be their de facto or expected nominee. But that said, if he didn't run, I don't know who the Democrats would run. And I think a lot of Democrats understand that. Kamala Harris is not popular. You know, Mayor Pete, who is now the Transportation Secretary, Pete, he doesn't have a good record. I'm talking to you right now. I'm about less than 30 miles from East Palestine, Ohio, which is where that awful train derailment took place. And that's one of a number of really transportation catastrophes that have happened on the watch of Secretary, you know, former Mayor Pete Buttigieg. And, you know, it's not his fault that that happened, but I don't think anybody is right now looking at this and saying, boy, I'll tell you, that Pete has just done a bang-up job with this derailment, hasn't he? I mean, nobody's thinking that. If anything, he's getting far more criticism than being commended for any idea. And he's tried to blame some of it on Trump, of all things, for whatever deregulation or whatever else might have taken place under Donald Trump. So if it's not Biden, I don't know who else it would be. So I guess he's going to run, and he'll be in his 80s if he runs or if he wins again. And it's a really strange scenario. I mean, I don't know, John. Maybe if Biden were to get reelected, he'd step down halfway through. That could be. I'm here in Western Pennsylvania. We just elected John Fetterman as senator.
Right.
And the poor guy's in a hospital right now, but he's getting treated for clinical depression. He's not even in the Senate. His wife might end up replacing him, and he didn't even get in to start. So who knows? Who knows?
His doctors say he's doing better this afternoon, so that is some fresh news on John Fetterman as he deals with depression. What are both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party missing? Because the majority of Americans are saying we want younger, fresh blood in there, and we keep bringing back the same names over and over again. Understanding the point of name and face recognition, how can you ignore a very clear message from the electorate on both sides?
Well, you would think so, and yet, you know, the electorate says that's what they want, right? You know, they want. You also hear that word. You know, we want diversity. Well, look who your choices were in 2020. You know, two old white guys who are almost 80 years old, right? We want candidates who look more like America. You had Hillary Clinton in 2016, and I guess the diversity there was that she was a woman. But she, you know, she came out of the so-called DC swamp. She had been in politics forever. She was the wife of Bill Clinton. In no way was she anything refreshing and new. You know, Barack Obama certainly was in 2008, which is probably why he beat John McCain, probably why he beat Mitt Romney in 2012. But the people claim that that's what they want. I think in 2016 with the Republicans, They had that. There were a dozen candidates at the start, people like Rand Paul, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz. I mean, these were really up-and-comers. A lot of them came out of that class who was elected through the Tea Party movement
right.
At one point. But who did they go with? You know, they went with this old billionaire real estate developer from Manhattan. And now that said, you know, Trump proved himself to be a tour de force. Right. The guy has enormous energy and stamina. But they claim they want new and fresh faces. So far, if your two front runners are Biden and Trump, doesn't look like they're going to get them.
Yeah.
But that remains to be seen.
Does it make any difference, Dr. Kengor, that some of the big money on the Republican side is not behind Trump?
I suppose it does, although I don't know how much money Trump really needs. I mean, he's kind of at this point, you know, a one-man, you know, Twitter machine, if his Twitter account has even been reactivated, I'm not sure. But he knows how to use social media better than anybody else. I mentioned East Palestine, Ohio. Trump went there. Trump was there. He was there a few days ago. In fact, you know, a lot of people in this part of the country who don't even know if they can drink their water, and I mean that. In fact, John, we set up an extra filtration system in our kitchen. We have an extra filter that we went out and bought, one of those Berkey filters, just because we don't even know if our water is something that we can drink yet. But Donald Trump went to East Palestine, Ohio, while Joe Biden went to Kiev in the Ukraine to meet with Vladimir Zelensky. Now, I'm very pro-Zelensky and very pro-Ukraine, and I was impressed with Biden's visit. So I'm not saying that that was a bad idea, but a lot of people around here are saying he should have come here first.
Right, it's the
optics. He should have come here before he went overseas.
Dr. Kengor, is it easy to label what happened in East Palestine, Ohio, as Joe Biden's Katrina?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that'd be very unfair, but it was extremely unfair for the liberal left to find a way to hang Katrina on George W. Bush.
Right.
I think that was one of the cruelest, nastiest, most ridiculous things that I ever saw. And in fact, going back to the start of our conversation, John, when we were talking about federalism and respecting governors and so forth, if you go back and you read George W. Bush's original statement about Katrina, George W. Bush had been governor of Texas. And he always thought that the governors didn't want the federal government meddling too much in the way they handled hurricanes and natural disasters. So you know, the way that Bush handled it was to call the governor in Louisiana and say, listen, I'm here for you, whatever you need. You need any help. But otherwise, you know, I don't want to go down there and make a spectacle out of things. And, you know, I don't want to get in your way. I was a governor. I know how this works. But whatever you need, I'll do it. And which should have been fine. Everybody should have loved that. Everybody should have liked that approach. But the partisans, the ideologues, they want to politicize everything, and they want to try to, you know, blame a hurricane on Bush, you know, or the aftermath of it, or the results of it, or whatever. But I guess in answer to your question, no, East Palestine will not be Joe Biden's because his liberal media is not going to let it be. They'll protect him and make sure that it never becomes that.
Yeah, that'll be an interesting thing to watch. Dr. Paul Kengor, thank you so much for your expertise and handicapping what perhaps will happen in 2024. It's going to be an interesting next 12 months. Dr. Kengor is a professor of political science at Grove City College in Pennsylvania and the executive director of the Center for Vision and Values. And you can get his latest book, The Devil and Bella Dodd. You know, we've got a few seconds remaining. Let me just sneak Keith in here real quickly. Keith, thanks for holding for so long. You're on the Drew Mariani Show.
Not a problem. Enjoy Dr. Kengor. Dr. Kengor, America 3.0, the book by James Bennett, kind of touched somewhat on this breaking the country up in putting basically national defense as the only thing. What are your thoughts on that? It sounds like you're familiar with the book.
You know, he had to run, but that's a very interesting book, and one that you can get on, you know, any one of the major book resellers online, because it really just talk about these real issues, Keith, that I think we're going to face in 2024 and beyond, and also the issues that you hear debated quite often about prosperity and wealth here in the United States of America. We live in interesting times, right? Drew's back tomorrow afternoon here on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.